Hey everyone, this is our episode for Thursday, June 18th, 2020. The pandemic has upended the lives of countless people across the world, but for refugees who fled their countries of origin to escape persecution based on race, religion, nationality, or ideology, COVID-19 makes it even harder to navigate healthcare, employment, education, and daily life. And new restrictions on refugee resettlement and immigration add yet another layer of concern for people seeking a new life in the U.S.
I think people need to understand that we left home because we have no choice, you know, and it's not something that we decide.
In this episode, we hear from a refugee who is a college student about what it's like to learn and live through COVID-19. And we ask a social worker and an immigration attorney about what social support and legal services are needed by refugees through the pandemic and beyond. I'm Jialian Yang, and from St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here. COVID-19 has complicated the college experience for students across the country. When campuses shut down to prevent the spread of the virus, students had to adjust to online learning, find housing, and change their graduation plans. And while some students are taking this chance to spend some much-needed time with close family and friends as they shelter in place, other students, like Nem Lek, a Zomi refugee from Myanmar, who we interviewed at the end of April, have returned home to additional pressures and responsibilities.
A lot of people now, they say it's time for us to relax and, you know, you have more free time. And I'm like, that's completely the opposite for me. I'm more busy now. I have all these different responsibilities that typically someone else who's not immigrants, who doesn't have a family background of a refugees, who doesn't speak English and all of these things don't have, you know.
Nemlek's family came to the U.S. for religious freedom, better living conditions, and opportunities for higher education. But adjusting to U.S. culture and navigating new systems in a different language was a challenge.
It was hard. We didn't speak English. It was shocking because culture is different. And so it was difficult to adjust to living here.
Nemlek came of age in the U.S., and she became more proficient in English than her parents.
I do translate for my parents a lot. I also translate for a lot of people within my community as well.
Having gone through the U.S. school system, Nemlek has stepped up as a caregiver and tutor for her two younger sisters, as homeschooling becomes the new norm in the era of COVID-19.
I have to take over, the role of the parents, kind of, and then also become a tutor and a teacher for them on top of my own, school responsibilities. Because right now I'm a college student as well. And so I have online classes that I have to attend. I still have the same amount of schoolwork. But then when I came home, due to campus closing and social distancing, I have to, make extra time for my sisters too.
And if caring for her sisters is her job, it's full time.
I wake up in the morning, brush my teeth, all of that stuff. If my sisters are not awake yet, do my own schoolwork, study. Since finals are coming up, I typically study, prepare for those. And then once my sisters are up, I feed them breakfast and all of that. And then we start school. My youngest sister, she's in preschool, and her teacher upload her assignments and videos on Google Classroom. So I use that and we go through the morning meeting, all the assignments together. And then in the meantime, I multitask with my other sister who is in second grade, and her teacher sent out an agenda and a schedule of what she needs to complete each day. So I look through that and see which one she can do independently. And then allow her to work independently while I tutor my other sister. And then once that's done, then I switch back. And that goes on for about, 4 to 5 hours in a day. Then I go back to my own schoolwork and I study and take breaks in between and then eat food and then go to sleep. And then it starts over again. That's pretty much my day for now.
Being proficient in English also allows Nemlek to help her family make sense of paperwork and doctor's orders. But it's just one part of navigating the U.S. healthcare system.
My family, we don't really have health insurance just because it's too costly. And, you know, and if we have the virus, like, God forbid, if someone in my family has the virus, like, honestly, I don't even know, like, what we're going to do. Because, you know, we don't have insurance. So I don't really know we're going to see, you know, physicians and get tested for it.
It's even scarier to consider what might happen if her mother, who works in a grocery store, catches the virus.
Let's say my mom can't work, then she's, you know, the one that has like our highest income. So I don't know how we're going to pay our bills.
Nemlik says that her extended family in Myanmar is doing okay financially, but explains that isn't always the case for other Zomi refugees who share the cultural expectation of sending money back to family in Myanmar.
I definitely know people in my community who are definitely worried about how they're going to send back money because, you know, the economy here is not great either, and you don't know whether you're going to get laid off or not. And a lot of the time, a lot of people, we live paycheck to paycheck. We don't save money because it's one, you don't get a lot of, you know, income, and two, like, you have to send back, being held responsible for, you know, your family, you know, how your family is going to bring food on their table every day in Burma is definitely like something that I think a lot of the Zomi people here in St. Louis community are struggling.
Living paycheck to paycheck while also sending money to family overseas leaves many refugee families with little to no money to visit relatives in their country of origin. Other refugee families remain separated because of the current administration's policies, which have tightened restrictions on asylum seekers, banned immigrants from majority Muslim countries, and reduced the number of refugees that could be admitted into the U.S. from 110,000 in 2016 to 18,000 in 2020.
I have a family member who's waiting to be processed in Malaysia, and they've been waiting for, you know, about like 7 years, 8 years. And the fact with COVID-19, we don't really know how much longer they're going to wait for. And living condition in Malaysia is not great either. And so they don't really have a lot of food. They can't work because businesses are shutting down. They don't have income. They don't really know like how long this is going to take. On top of that, like, they don't know if they should go back to where they come from, and kind of just go through the struggle, or wait it out and see. A lot of like family members are worried about their kids because the longer they stay there, because schooling is not great in Malaysia for refugee kids.
Nemlik reminds us that refugees who have been admitted into the U.S., which once admitted more refugees than all other countries combined, will require support through the pandemic and beyond.
We care about people around us. We want to be friends with them, but it's kind of difficult for a lot of people to initiate that relationship. And so I think it's really important for people here in America to also initiate those conversation and those relationship with refugees here. If they have someone, a neighbor who's refugees and who's in need of, I don't know, food or, you know, in assistance, or someone who needs, who have kids and they need their homework, like help for with their kids' homework or paperwork or anything like that. I know that there are a lot of people out there who probably need help with all of those things. And there are a lot of refugees who doesn't speak English. And so helping them in anything that require that language barrier, you know, that would be super helpful.
That neighborly support could ease the pressure on refugees like Nemlik, who feel a heavy responsibility to help others in her own community, even as she continues to study and work to support her family and make a life for herself.
I hope to obviously get good education, go to good school, get high degree, and then use those education that I received for back to my community and back to my family, and potentially hopefully bring it back to my community within Burma. We want to just have a comfortable, stable life where we're financially stable. That's probably the most important thing. and then help back our community in Burma as much as we can and our family back there.
Social support and legal services are crucial to resettling refugees and helping them adjust to life in a new country. But access to support and services has changed during the pandemic. So up next, we hear from a social worker about how the pandemic has clarified priorities for a local resettlement organization, and an immigration attorney about how immigration processes are being complicated because of COVID-19. Usually, the International Institute of St. Louis, a local refugee resettlement organization, is a hub of activity. On any given day, you might find refugees taking classes, departing for field trips to sites across the region, or having lunch with volunteers. But these aren't usual times, and Rosie Lang, the director of social work for the International Institute, says things aren't quite the same now that the building is closed to visitors to prevent the spread of COVID-19.
But just because we're working remotely does not mean that we are not very active in engaging with clients, and we certainly are. Especially for the elderly, we've ramped up contact from case managers and therapists working on the program. So we are encouraging things like gardening and exercise. Getting out in nature is really important. We're also trying to build the capacity with our clients to do groups remotely. So using things like WhatsApp to help connect them in a way that they might not otherwise have been connected.
The International Institute serves refugees from various backgrounds, with the most refugees currently resettling in St. Louis from the Democratic Republic of Congo and Afghanistan. Rosie has been with the Institute for over a decade, and she has her hands full, ensuring that her department continues to provide intensive case management and support services to survivors of labor and sex trafficking, refugees with health and mental health conditions, and LGBTQ people with HIV positive status. She explains that aging refugees are some of the most vulnerable among them, especially as the pandemic reduces opportunities to connect.
So we do a lot of good work with case management and also mental health screenings and groups to prevent isolation for them. And then, of course, we also have a clinical therapy program where we work with individuals trying to deal with everything from adjustment stress to life in the United States to, you know, the impact of war trauma or sexual assault, things of that nature. The experiences overseas, perhaps with war trauma or other events in terms of conflict, the idea of being told you need to stay at home, it is unsafe to go outside, as we saw for several weeks with the stay-at-home orders, can be re-triggering for individuals.
Remote case management and support services help refugees adjust to life in the U.S. for the long term. But the International Institute has also had to focus on priorities that help refugees survive the current crisis.
Basic needs, financial security and communications. This has included delivery of critical goods like hand sanitizer, cloth face masks, grocery gift cards, toilet paper directly to not only our new arrivals, but some of our other clients as well who are particularly vulnerable. And of course, for our new arrivals, we're assisting them in getting set up for food stamps, getting their social security cards still, all of that so that we can assist them in navigating the benefits to which they are eligible for. We've also been working on the front lines helping immigrants and refugees apply for unemployment benefits where eligible.
Rosie observes that the everyday concerns of refugees during the pandemic mirror concerns of the wider community about health and economic well-being.
We took a recent small sample from our population and identified that approximately 67% had some form of income loss. And this included income loss either from losing a job, furlough, reduced hours, or similar loss from a contributing member in the household. And that kind of mirrors what we're seeing when we look at the data more broadly. So Migrant Policy Institute recently put out a data analysis that showed that immigrant women had the highest unemployment rates in the country across the board, in addition to the Latinx population, with immigrant women having an 18% unemployment rate in April.
Financial instability and limited access to resources make it hard for refugee parents to balance work, childcare, and homeschooling, which means that refugee children who've already had their lives upended in many ways may have an even tougher time learning through the pandemic.
It's a challenge for kids. You know, we talk about the importance of communicating what's going on in a truthful way, but also in a way that's not going to be traumatizing to them. And so, you know, when we think about kiddos who have come already from a long migration process and have had many adverse childhood experiences in many cases already, it can be an especially big challenge to be faced with yet another community trauma, if you will. So the schools have done a really great job of trying to support our immigrant and refugee families who have children, but it is tough, right? Because we're dealing with technology here. We're dealing with remote access, remote learning, and that even if you fulfill those hard tech pieces like giving a laptop or an iPad, etc., can be a challenge for our clients, you know, to navigate, whether it be paying for internet access or just navigating the technology in and of itself.
And as Nemlek explained earlier, navigating the U.S. healthcare system is a major struggle, which is why the International Institute is sharing public health information in multiple languages.
Since the beginning of the pandemic, we've been pushing out robocalls in native language to over 800 immigrants, refugees, asylees, and special immigrant visa holders. And we've also put these recordings on our website to really broaden the reach of our impact. And we cover everything from COVID-19 symptoms in native language, precautionary measures such as wearing face masks, physical distancing, sanitation practices. We've also pushed out calls related to the stay-at-home orders and resources for food and other basic needs as well.
But more than information, sometimes what refugees need is an advocate to accompany them as they seek services.
A lot of the individuals that we work with do have limited English proficiency. And so it's not always easy to call up a doctor's office. Even if the doctor's office offers interpretation, it can be sometimes a challenge to communicate that you have that need on the phone. And so we do hear about that. We do hear occasionally about challenges getting through with some of the hotlines and things of that nature. And so we're really focused on ensuring that we're helping break down those barriers for our clients.
Breaking down barriers to healthcare, resources, and social support is an ongoing effort. And what's carrying Rosie through this time is centering humanity through a challenging crisis.
I think that recognition that these are the times that really test who we are as human beings is carrying me forward and seeing the impact that we are really making on the ground, whether it be through something as simple as deliveries of grocery gift cards or hand sanitizer, or showing how we can be allies in the community in many ways. We're essentially living in a social studies chapter. I've heard it say many times. And so I think that is carrying forward. You know, thinking about the work that I want to do for my community and how I want to be able to say that I responded, right, is something that's really important. And I think looking for the successes and not just looking at the challenges, looking at what we have accomplished has been really beneficial.
Javad Kazali, an immigration and civil rights attorney who represents people ranging from Major League Baseball players to refugees and asylum seekers, is getting through the pandemic with a similar attitude.
We are fortunate in the fact that we're winning a lot more than we're losing, but a single loss hits you really, really hard. And you just have to teach yourself how to move on as much as you can from a loss and really, really savor your victories.
Javad has over a decade of experience in high-level immigration policy positions under the Bush and Obama administrations.
there are two types of people that I think people conflate: refugees and asylees. So refugees are people who are processed overseas with the United Nations High Commission on Refugees. And they're usually in refugee camps. They go through years and years of background screening, and then they're resettled in the United States through refugee resettlement organizations. There are people who are in the United States who individually are looking for the same types of protections, and they file for something called asylum, which is similar, but the difference is it's all done within the U.S.
He's now a private bar attorney and a passionate board member for the Community Development Corporation of the International Institute of St. Louis.
The first place a refugee goes to figure out how to speak English is the International Institute. The first place a refugee goes to learn how to grocery shop is the International Institute. The first place a refugee goes to figure out how to file for their citizenship or their green cards, the International Institute. They also go there to learn how to get a job. If that resource is gone, that causes a lot of anxiety. It makes it so that people don't know where their safety net is.
And he's especially concerned because funding for the International Institute is tied to the number of refugees being resettled, and refugee admission caps have been drastically reduced in recent years.
We were one of the largest cities in America when it came to resettlement of refugees. In the 90s, that's when the big Bosnian push came. And what you've seen is that we are now, 10, 20, 30 years later, and we're seeing how well the Bosnian community has assimilated to America while at the same time keeping a foothold in the old land.
Racial perceptions impact how well refugees are able to adjust to new communities in the U.S. So Black refugees and refugees of color often have different experiences than their white counterparts. But what many asylees and refugees in the U.S. share during this time is a sense of uncertainty surrounding family reunification.
They are tormented by the fact that they have family members who have passed all of the security screenings, everything that they've had to do, who can't come over here because this government has decided that we are no longer a country that takes, your huddled masses and allows us to bring refugees in. And that is having a very, very, very bad effect on St. Louis specifically, because that's a core portion of our economic model.
He explains that refugees and asylees may start in lower wage service jobs when they first come to the U.S., but those with education often become entrepreneurs and job creators once they adjust to their new lives.
They're starting businesses at a much higher clip than Americans, and they tend to be employers rather than employees down the road. Now you look at the Fortune 500 companies in America, and the majority of them have a founder who wasn't born here. So they've been a net huge positive for places like St. Louis, places like Minneapolis, where they've got a large Somali community, places like Los Angeles, where the Iranian community is huge, Dallas with the Vietnamese, China is, they've kind of built a lot of the infrastructure of New York and San Francisco.
Despite the extent to which refugees and asylees have supported economic growth across the country, many efforts to secure green cards and citizenship have been put on pause, even in the midst of a recession. But cases that pertain to those who are being detained by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, are moving forward.
I saw a report recently that says that even though ICE is under testing its people, its detainees, that 50% of the detainees that they've tested have tested positive for COVID, and they're still deporting them. So we're exporting this disease to other countries.
And ICE detention centers are a health risk for many of the same reasons that jails and prisons have become hotspots for COVID-19.
The first part of the pandemic, really, I spent almost exclusively on fighting to get my clients who were in ICE custody out, either to convince a judge that circumstances have changed and that this person should be bonded out, or for people who had real uphill battles they made the hard decision that instead of staying in custody to fight these battles and risking their health, that they wanted to be deported as quickly as possible. So then trying to expedite getting them, their case finalized, getting them out of those hellhole detention centers as quickly as possible.
The stakes are high for Javad and his clients at a time when immigration cases for people without refugee or asylee status are already complicated. He's seen a major downturn in the number of new clients who want to start applications for green cards and citizenship.
At the same time, a certain percentage of our cases are reactive. You know, somebody got into trouble with immigration or they did it on their own and they're getting a denial. And the fact that those agencies are closed is also helping us and keeping us from having to deal with bad issues.
But while those reactive cases are being postponed, Javad is having to deal with mounting piles of paperwork to process relatively simple immigration cases. And that's because of something called the Inadmissibility on Public Charge Grounds Final Rule, which was implemented by the current U.S. administration at the end of February after several federal courts issued injunctions preventing the rule from being implemented. The public charge rule denies changes in status to immigrants who are deemed by the Department of Homeland Security to likely at any time to become a public charge. What that means in practice is that immigrants who receive public benefits such as SNAP, Section 8, or Medicaid for over a year may be unable to receive green cards or visas. And it also means applications for green cards, visas, and citizenship are longer than ever.
Nobody can fill out an 87-page form of any kind on their own without messing it up. You know, we have very expensive software that does that. We have a team that's trained. So it's taken away the ability for people to do this by themselves. That application that I put in, though, once I put the evidence in, was close to 400 pages. And this was for somebody who was a straightforward, totally did everything right, green card holder, no unlawful status, no criminality, nothing. Well, when an application becomes 400 pages, it means it's going to take our firm a lot longer to do it, which means it's going to be more expensive.
And even though the public charge rule doesn't apply to refugees and asylees, the increased time and expense involved in filing extensive applications for immigrants who don't have refugee and asylee status means that Javad has less capacity to take on pro bono and low bono cases for some of his most vulnerable clients.
It's hurting us because before, when I had a case that cost $2,000, which is real money, that's now a $4,000 case, and less people can afford us.
But what motivates him to push forward are the times when his team can make a difference.
Yesterday, I found out that I have a client who applied for his green card by himself 5 years ago, and his case was just stuck. And eventually he came to me, and I had to we filed a federal lawsuit in his case, and the government responded by denying his application. And we fought that again, and yesterday we found out that after we filed everything, they haven't informed us yet, but we went online, and the government, after a five-year fight, has granted his green card. That was a huge day. You know, like that was a send an email to the whole firm, everybody, enjoy your day. You got to learn to very much savor your victories. We've seen a much higher uptick in threats against immigrants, people coming up to people demanding to know what their religion is, demanding to know what country they're from, demanding to know whether or not they support Americans. But we've also seen the corollary, people reaching out to the immigrant population and saying, hey, I know things here are messed up. What can I do to help you? What can I do to support you?
This show is produced by me, Jalian Yang, and my co-producer, Lauren Brown. This show is overseen by Robert Peterson, Director of Radio Programming and Operations at St. Louis Public Radio. From St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.